netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
FX Guide is proudly sponsored by SIGGRAPH Asia. FX Podcast is the official podcast of SIGGRAPH Asia, this year being held in Hong Kong, December 12th to 15th. For more information, go to siggraph.org/asia2011.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. I'm Jeff Huser. Today we're focused on the color correction of the film Cowboys and Aliens, but more specifically, this is part of our series talking to the best colorists in the world. Mike Seymour is going to be talking with an old friend of ours, Steve Scott, from eFilm. Before we get to that, I just wanted to mention a few things on the site. John Montgomery and I just got back from Amsterdam for IBC, and you'll find two FX Guide TVs on FX Guide. The first one covering the release of the Foundry's new conform tool, Hero, which I'm very excited about, and I think you should take a look at if you're a Nuke user, After Effects user, who has a need for conforms to feed your workflow. Also in the second one, we talk to Ion, see what they've been up to, talk to Adobe about the news from the show that they acquired Iridis, and we also take a look at SGO Mystica, which we've been hearing quite a bit about as it's being used on The Hobbit and several other shows. It's getting a lot of buzz due to its real-time capabilities, so check those out. Those are the FX Guide TV episodes. We also have a roundtable podcast talking about some of the other things we saw at the show in a more informal way. There's also a written article with more information. Also, not having to do with IBC, Mike Seymour has written a new article in the Art of series that have been so popular. This one's on fluid sims. It's quite a technical geek out kind of article that I know you will enjoy. There's a new VFX show on Poltergeist. It's been a busy couple of weeks over on FX Guide, so head on over there and check it out. All right, so let's jump into this podcast. I have to mention Steve Scott and I worked together years ago at the Post Group. He was a visual effects artist then. In fact, it was early on in the days of FX Guide, and Steve contributed one of the first tips. In fact, that tip still lives on over at our training site, FX PhD, in the resources free tips and tricks area. We moved the tips over there during a recent makeover of the sites, but that's the kind of sharing and contributing to the community guy that Steve Scott is, and is among the reasons that he's really one of my favorite people I've ever had the pleasure of working with. And as you'll hear in this podcast, his spirit, attitude, and work ethic just come right through. So let's head over now to Mike as he talks with Steve Scott about color correction in the film Cowboys and Aliens.
I need to know where you came from.
So do I.
What is that thing?
Why are you asking me?
Because you shot it.
The way I work with John and Maddie, and I am so fortunate to be able to work with them, is there is a lot that goes on in the process of coming to what the final look for the VFX will be. And what Roger and Maddie and John did at one point early on, and I strongly encourage this whenever possible, is we do DI work that will never be seen in the final movie. And by that I mean we will have collaborative group discussions with the material in the DI room where we'll be looking at plates before there's any VFX, and we'll be exploring exactly what Maddie wants to do and what John wants to do, mainly Maddie. And of course, my role in all of this is to help realize and bring the vision that the DP has to the big screen. That's my primary focus, is, how can we kind of create the mind's eye image that the DP has. And of course, you get somebody as brilliant as Matty Libatique, and he pretty much brings that vision to the room. So you're not doing rescuing with his work. You're doing finessing, and he's so aware of what he shot and why he shot it in a certain way that he knows the tools inside and out. And when he gets into this room, you find out that he shot it a certain way, which is not the finished version of what he wants to do. It's basically the point, he shoots it to the point where he wants it to bring in the DI, and then he'll go further knowing the tools that he has at his disposal. And I find that more and more with DPs, is that once they become well-versed, they're shooting things maybe a little differently, and that they don't necessarily view it as the finished piece. They will view the final DI timed piece as the finished piece.
Can you give me an example of that?
Well, I could give you a million examples, but yes, for example, you will have various weather conditions. And, of course, shooting in New Mexico, as they did, there were extreme weather conditions and overcast and sunny. And we've had this issue on basically every movie that we've dealt with shot in New Mexico, is they really do have the extreme weather, and things can change at a moment's notice. So you may be hesitant to shoot something knowing that the clouds are, that it's overcast in one shot and not in another, but when you know you have the DI tools, you won't necessarily worry about that as much, and you'll get the kind of coverage that will allow you to go in and do the things you know you can do in a DI, you know, increase the highlights or cast bring some highlights into the face of a rock or darken the one side of the face so that it looks like there's more direction to the light coming in, and so they know they can do that. They know that because I have a background in painting and illustration, that I will know how to logically create those shadows in a believable way. And so, you know, we collaborate on things like that. But the other thing we do is there may be a shot that is not nearly where they want it to be, and we will go in and we will bring the shot up and we'll start playing with mats and this and that. And we'll basically do what I would call a semi-matte painting treatment of the shot, and we will basically give an idealized version on a still frame that Roger can then take and use as a reference for when they're doing their final DI shot.
So,
and I can't go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, obviously, you and I have been friends for many years, but just for those that don't know, obviously, you have a tremendous track record in being a supervising digital colorist, and you've done a lot of effects films, though I'm going to deviate by not discussing effects shots with you today. But you obviously, apart from the anything else, you know, Thor, you'd worked on Day the Earth Stood Still, Wolverine, just tons of effects type stuff. But, of course, Iron Man 2 is a huge one. But prior to that, you actually come from an effects background, so you're very comfortable with that side of the business.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, you know, I come from I come from that side, but before then, and more importantly, I come from a painting background. And I draw so heavily on my knowledge of perspective or composition and what will make an image look real and convincing. And I'm so grateful that I had the experience of facing a blank sheet of paper or canvas and having to look carefully at the world around me and translate that onto that sheet of paper. It just burns what reality and imagery and it looks like in a way that I just can't imagine how I could do this without that foundation. And I've often found it very interesting that people tend to use reference of like, oh, how did they do this in this other movie, or how did they do that effect here, or how does the reflection look? Well, let's look at this movie or that picture. It's like, I often think just really go out in the world and look at reference. If you want to know what a city is supposed to look like on a cloudy day, go out and look at a city in a cloudy day. You know, to reference real life as much as possible. And I'm always shocked at, for myself, when I go look at a sunset or see different lighting conditions, the actual reality of color in that composition, as opposed to what I would ever get on an exposure, a digital exposure, a film exposure. And if you ever have the opportunity, take your phone or your camera or whatever, and look through the lens or look on your display of what you're seeing when you're looking at a sunset, and then look at the actual sunset, and you're just shocked at what you don't see and what's not included in that digital reproduction of it, so much to the point that often when I really want to know the truth about imagery, I will look at that same sunset, I'll take a notebook, I'll draw the horizon line, and I will make notes about the colors I see. I will write, this is an ivory, that's a pale blue, that's a, you know, periwinkle, whatever, so that I am making very specific notes about the reality of color I can see, because one of my great frustrations is how little you can reproduce the real amazing palette range of colors that your eyes can see. And it's always about, okay, here's what you're dealt with in the exposure, but based on your knowledge and your notes and your observations, here's the colors that should be there that are not on the film, and let's try and recreate those. That's always interesting for me.
Well, now, obviously, we're friends, but I actually have an enormous amount of respect for your work. I just think it's magnificent. But I'm going to be really perverse and move away from talking about effects type shots in an effects film because I want to just see how you dealt with some of the stuff that is what you're referring to, this referencing of the real world, but also just your artistic background and your understanding of light. So if we can, let's start discussing a couple of shots in this film away from aliens and away from big explosions and maybe the work of ILM. So the most obvious thing that comes to mind is that the film has several distinctive feels to it, and one of those is very narrative driven, which is his inability to remember what happens, which produces quite an interesting visual effect. Though, interestingly, in the film, that is used not only for him thinking back to what happened to his wife, girlfriend. Have we established that she was a wife? That when she was taken.
His partner. You know, I apologize. I don't know for sure if they ever got married.
Yeah, neither do I. But let's call her his partner.
I think it was, you know, they would have probably got married if they weren't already, but it was certainly the beginning of a relationship.
But that recall of that event, which is it's just heavily fogged by his own alien abduction, is also referenced when he's carrying. And this is a big spoiler alert, but he's carrying a character we think is his new love interest. She turns out to be another alien, and she appears to die. And in both of those occasions, you used a very interesting color palette to inform the audience of what was going on. Can you discuss that and how you approached it?
Oh, I can discuss it. You know, that's a very interesting sequence, and I can only take very limited credit for that. I mean, we ended up doing a lot of work, but not for the reasons you may guess. Actually, Maddie went in and shot on a particular film stock and did the kind of a cross-processing treatment to it that really created much of that effect. So the effect was built into the footage, and Maddie did a very, he's always pushing the limits, and he did a very creative job. And you'd be shocked if you saw the actual film of how much it looks like that. The challenging part in all of that was they needed coverage, and they had certain shots that were shot in this very extreme process and other shots that weren't shot that way at all, just standard exposure. And so the trick was, how do you emulate that extreme look? And so we had a mixture of shots, some that were shot that way and some that were completely different. And the challenge was to just match them. And it's as you would do with any, you know, if you were sitting and trying to copy a great master, you break down the image and you make sure you understand what the components are, and you just try to recreate it with the other footage. And so that's what we're trying to do, is just make sure everything fit. You know, there was lots of grain in the cross process material, and so we went and we had grain emulation. We would, you know, you couldn't do any kind of overall color correction that was going to match, so we would treat the low end in a certain way and the sky in a certain way and lots of keys and windows and everything on the footage that was shot normally to emulate that. So that was basically the process on that. It was more of a matching, emulating. And of course, you know, Maddie loved what he had shot and wanted to just celebrate it and accentuate certain things, maybe a little more glow in the highlights and things like that. A little more saturation in parts, a little less in others. And
I was going to say, for me, that the shots had some really punchy saturation, and you weren't afraid of really thumping the whites in that sequence.
Nope. You know, and then again, I have to give credit to Maddie. He's the one who he's a very, very brave cinematographer. I just was, it's just always, I learned so much by dealing with these people who have their ideas and are brave and kind of open your eyes to a whole new way of thinking about film and with the possibilities that lie therein. So,
because I could argue at a purely technical level, and I'm certainly not taking this position, but just for point of discussion, I could argue that technically that shot was either clipping or wrong in its highlights, that it was distinctly not a traditional grade. Yeah. And yet, of course, what do I care, because it works in the sequence. How much do you think that's sort of carefulness about technical considerations versus just if it works, it works? Where do you sit on that line?
Oh, I think absolutely. If it works, it works, and you don't want to encumber a creative for you know, one of the things I find myself saying to DPs often is, don't lose your nerve. You know, they may have pushed it in a way that's really brave and interesting, and I almost sometimes hate to see them back away from it. And very often the studios are vocal if they don't like the way something's going, and they'll tell you and they'll let you know. And you have very strong creative vision from our VFX supervisor to our director in particular, and the DP, and it's a very collaborative effort. And sometimes they will say, you know, no, this is too much, we don't want to go there. Also, you're reminding me there was some Canon footage in there that, you know, the Maddie just looked practically right into the sun at times, and there were some digital artifacts and things, and sometimes we chose to mitigate that as much as we could. So, but you know what? I absolutely love those challenges, and I love them thinking bravely, and I love facilitating that in any way I can. And I've also found that, not necessarily with Maddie, but sometimes you will sit in a room with a DP or a director, and you will go over something 100 times, and you'll be ready to pull out your hair out. You can never let that show, of course, but, you know, because your whole purpose as a good colorist is to facilitate and make the creatives feel comfortable with going through whatever their process is and exploring whatever they want to explore without, you know, the overlay of you being tired or frustrated. But I have found that you learn so much, and you can never question a great artist's process. If they want to do something 1 time or 20 times or 100 times, you just have to be there to help them do that and explore as they want. And you can never say, oh, I think this is reasonable or unreasonable. You know, you're there to realize the vision of the creatives, and that takes a really special person, not necessarily good or bad person, but just somebody who can really understand that, kind of suppress their ego, and just really go along for the ride with these creatives.
What's your process on that sequence? Were you looking at what had been shot, getting something up, and then showing it, or were you sitting beside someone the whole time discussing it as you went? Do you like to have some time to just... Because I find sometimes it's good to... You can look at stuff on paper, or you can even look at stuff when projected, but you actually have to get in there and kind of play with it to start feeling it. You really understand the footage.
Oh, absolutely. And of course, you know, I think the best results always come when you are really working in close collaboration with the DP. They know what they intended when they shot it, and very often it's the most uncomfortable experiences where you really are just there forever going over something a million times and working with a creative. Those are the times when you really... your eyes are open to the possibilities that you never anticipated. And if you are comfortable with what you're doing, oftentimes you're just not being stretched or learning as much as when you're uncomfortable with what you're doing. And certainly Maddie can take me there where I'm going, is this going to work? Or what? And then we get there and it's like, wow, that's great, or it's really brave, or I never would have done that to begin with, but I'm so glad that I came along for this little ride because now I've learned something. I've got a new arrow in my quiver, and you know, you're just a more informed artist at that point.
Tell me, as an artist, which tools are you primarily using when you're... Well, what did you grade this on for, I guess, is the question.
We have a proprietary version of Luster called eWorks, and it's, you know, we have the largest bank of film recorders and scanners, and we have a very particular infrastructure that we have to have access to any number of movies and switch files around quickly between just huge volumes of material. And, you know, we're doing sessions that we're doing remotely to London and New York, and so we have particular needs for our software, and so we've really customized our eWorks stations. And I'll tell you, my background's in compositing, so when I get into the when I first got into these systems, the thing I was thinking is, oh my gosh, I was used to Inferno and Flame and all of the amazing capabilities you have and the endless sparks or plugins that you have and batch compositing and all that kind of, and it was really interesting for me because I came into this thinking, wow, I don't have nearly all the tools I'm used to. I've still got Roto and I've got Keyers and I've got animation and those sorts of things, but it's not what I would love to have and where I think the system should go, which should be a complete bank of all those options. But it's very interesting because people who come from a more traditional telecine background or a lab timing background, you know, the idea of having to deal with Roto or animation or keys is very intimidating and daunting. So they're coming at it in a way that is like, wow, there's too many capabilities. Why would you ever want to use those? And I'm coming from a point of view like there's not enough and I could use 100 more. Of course, the danger of being a compositor and getting into this industry is as a compositor, you have, you know, a certain number of shots in a movie and not very many often. and when you're in DI, you have to deal with every single shot in the movie from fade up to fade out. Everyone has to have your touch on it, and you just can't stop and do the sort of things and be as crazily detail oriented as you can be when you're dealing with single shots. That was the biggest shock and the biggest hurdle for me when I started. And
you also have to have more of a sense of consistency and transition, as in a sort of a plot sense transition on your overall palettes.
Oh yes, and it's also one of the things I really stress, and I'm very, very, very fortunate to work with some wonderfully talented up-and-coming colorists, and I have one who's got a background in compositing and matte painting, and another who's got some artistic background, and one of the first things we really just have to focus on is continuity. The foundation of what we do is that everything flows and matches, and you know, you can so easily, if you come from a compositing background, get stuck on, oh, I'm going to match this sky to the other sky, I'm going to have to do this matte, I'm going to pull this key, and blah, 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 and pretty soon, you know, you're just bogged down, and you really are constantly having to reevaluate where you are, how much time you've got, what are your priorities, do you have time to do this, what's the most efficient way to do it, and you know, you really have to bring a whole new set of organizational and time management tools into this process.
So technically, this was shot importantly on film because they wanted the
yes, anamorphic.
Yeah, and they wanted that sort of traditional Western look. So
yes.
What color space and how you? I mean, I presume you're just going into some Cineon printer density base color space from a film scan to a 2K, or are you doing a 4K pipe? What's the master format that you're working through?
This ended up being 2K because of the need to tie in with the visual effects that were done in 2K. So,
and did the anamorphic pose any interesting problems? Because there is certain halations and characteristics that happen of anamorphic lenses that don't tend to happen, in addition to lens flares, that don't tend to happen.
And I love all of those, so no. I just think those are all part of the wonderful parts of anamorphic. You know, anytime I see a lens flare or some anomaly, I think of, oh, I remember seeing that in Close Encounters or any other number of wonderful movies. So I love the anomalies of anamorphic, and I, you know, you just get such a wonderful sense of depth and information and latitude in film that I just treasure.
I'm gonna swing back around and discuss you a bit more on the technical at the end if I can, as we look sort of down the track. But let me just then now discuss two scenes that I wanted to hit on you with, which are, I guess, not big effect sequences. The first one of these is at the very beginning of the film, you have our hero waking up effectively. We don't know where he is. He doesn't know where he is. And he comes across three unfortunate souls who won't be with us for very long. I'm wondering about that in terms of getting a very stark grade, but not losing the faces into dark contrast, and yet still being able to get that sense of there's a certain bleakness about the way you graded it. Could you discuss that?
Well, I think that I wish I could take more credit for that sequence, but it's remarkably close to what Maddie shot. I mean, what we were doing there is really just lining it up for continuity, and then there were certain sequences and areas where they wanted the sky to match, and so we would go key into the sky and we would match those along various areas that they wanted to bring out in the landscape. They had some scalps on their that they were carrying along with them. So we would window those and animate those and bring those up and see into the faces sometime. But I just can't take tons of credit for that sequence because it really is pretty much a reflection of what Maddie shot. And I thought it was very stark and beautiful. And it's interesting you say stark. It is, but it's also very colorful at the same time. You're feeling the burn on his skin and you're feeling the kind of decrepit nature of the people coming up to him that are, you know, as you say, short for this world. And
Daniel Craig's face seemed really interesting because there was a lot of texture, presumably makeup, on his face. He's theoretically going to get shadowed by that hat, and you don't want it to look artificial, so it looked really natural.
It is pretty much as shot, and again, he had a lot of makeup there, a lot of dirt makeup, they just did a great job of making him look as grungy as possible, everyone in that sequence. And we did have certain issues where, for example, when you're looking up to Daniel as, you know, he's beating the other guys, there was a bit of flaring in the lens, and so we were able to help with that. The funny thing is, if I went and looked at those shots now, I would find, you know, many things and many windows that we did. But again, it's stuff that I'm sitting here with the DP and we're discussing, and he says, you know, I'd really like if we could do this and you do that. So if I went back and looked, there'd be a lot of work done to that sequence, but nothing that is, you know, like changing the lighting or making it something it wasn't. And also, again, the big issue in that sequence, and with a lot of sequences, was just the difficulty of the weather switching at a moment's notice. And I also know that ILM and Roger played a big part in certain scenes where they would, you know, do clouds and, build in some clouds and some lighting into some of the scenes that didn't quite match up. And again, we had a long session with Roger and John and Maddie, where we would actually do still frames and say, well, here's the reference that we want. And I want to just say at this point, I cannot stress, I think the most important element in any big VFX movie, particularly for a VFX supervisor, is for them to be as engaged as they possibly can in doing pre-timing in the DI, because you're going to be in an environment, in a place where you are going to see the absolute truth about the imagery you're dealing with in a color-calibrated room. I can say for eFilm that's very true, and you're going to be able to depend with the DP and the director and anybody who's making critical decisions at the end of the line to do that early and up front, because you will be in collaboration, you'll be a meeting of the minds, and you will save yourself so much work down the line when you finally have to have these shots dropped in. And ideally, what makes everyone look good, the DP, the VFX supervisor, is if they drop in and you don't have to do much at all to them. And again, a lot of the creative work you do can be in those initial sessions and initial timing. And if you are worried about, oh, I don't want to do anything to these plates because I don't want to affect them, you know, even if you're just getting a reference, even if you just have a file that you can bring in and look and say, I know this is what they want, this is the direction they had, that just saves you so much guesswork. And you'll know if you're looking at your monitor and it looks really wrong that, wow, something's wrong with our lookup table, or the monitor's wrong or something, because you'll know that file, you were there and you were sure it was right. And also just the active engagement along the way of the VFX supervisor monitoring, seeing, being heavily involved, if I were a VFX supervisor, I would just view the DI as such a critical, time-saving, face-saving, reputation-saving tool that you wouldn't be able to keep me out of there. And I just want to encourage people to that. And remember, you can always keep your original source material and just have this as a reference if you don't want to use a reference. And sometimes when you're in the room, there might be some issue that would be so easy to solve right then and there. For example, you're doing a pan and you want to keep the lighting even in the shot, and you pan over and all of a sudden the lighting shifts in a radical way. That's something you could very easily solve in a DI right there, and you will be dealing with a plate where you don't have those issues anymore. And you'll know that, well, everybody agreed that this is what we wanted to do. So, you know, very often we'll do sessions where it's like, okay, let's do just a printer light timing pass on this. Okay. Now, and then I'll suggest, you know what, we've had to bring this up about a bit, and now the blacks are all milky. Do you mind if I bring them down? And they'll say, sure, just give us the time plate and that plate, and we'll be able to pick and choose which ones we want. And inevitably, they choose the play that, you know, we did the little help with. Because my background's in compositing, you know, I know what's going to help. I know that if you're giving somebody this consistent rack of shots that were all from the same sequence, it's going to be very helpful. You're just going to have to put in your effect, and you're not going to have to worry about, oh, is this timed properly, or do I have to compensate for this? Or you'll have scenes that are supposed to be, you know, the same take, but maybe they had to do it the next day. Let us line that up for you so that we can take care of the continuity issues. And again, you're just doing something on top of something that you know has been established and accepted. And there are experiences. I worked on a movie a while ago, Jarhead, with Pablo Hellman. Roger Deakins shot it. And I had a discussion with Pablo. We had worked long ago in a digital domain. I said, you know what? Roger is going so extreme in this correction. If you try to do something in just a normalized plate, you're going to have something that we're going to have to stretch and pull extraordinarily hard in the DI room. Why don't we take the gamble and do the timing that Roger wants, and then you build your effect on that? And that's what we did. And I'm telling you, Pablo did such a spectacular job on those oil field plates. It was as if it were shot that way. And I know part of the success of that was that we didn't have to do much to it once it got back to the DI. They knew what they were dealing with, and they could build it onto this extreme timing. So sometimes that works best.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And obviously Pablo is a really good supervisor, though he was at ILM, right, doing that?
Yes, he was.
Yeah, sorry. You mentioned DD, but that was – you'd worked before a DD, is that right?
Yes, yeah. We started right. Our careers at the same time, actually. So he was at DD and I was at DD, and we were both compositors.
So in that particular instance where you're giving stuff up, say, to ILM, like on this film, you're going to give them basically two copies of the shots rather than giving them a base and some LUTs to take it to a different place, because presumably it's more than you can do in LUTs because it's regionalized color correction.
Well, we will also distribute LUTs, standard viewing LUTs, to all vendors. And
yep.
I would say if something, you know, we're really pretty good and we're very responsive if something doesn't seem to be working out correctly. But basically, if you've got something and it's not looking right, you know, it's a good flag to say that, because you know the stuff has been timed, you know it's looking right. I'll tell you something that can happen is if you don't pre-time, you'll give shots to various vendors, and there may be a problem where something's underexposed or overexposed or some problem, and they'll look at the material and they go, oh my gosh, this is wrong, our LUT is wrong, because this can't be right. So the DP ends up looking bad that way. The visual effects people don't know what's going on. You know, the DI facility, it's a question whether they're giving you the right files and if they're properly converted, when really it's just a matter that, hey, there was a problem with the shot. It needs to be pre-timed, you know. So, and maybe the DP intended it that way, and he knew he was going to have the DI tool. So that's another great reason why you want to pre-time plates as much as possible, because you want the opportunity to help with any issues that the DP may have ran into, and just know what you're dealing with early on.
Well, my second sequence I'd like to focus on is the stuff around the fire. Now, Olivia Wilde comes out of the flames. It's obviously an effect sequence. I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about you have quite a few shots where it's at night around the Indian campfire. You shot on film, so there's theoretically not going to be, you know, vast amounts of latitude into the blacks. It looked very clean to me. I don't know whether you did clean-up work on it or how you managed to do it, but you have the same problem that obviously it's lit not just from the fire, but it has to look like it's lit by the fire. Can you discuss that sequence?
Well, basically, there were issues with when, number one, I thought Roger did just a spectacular job. Roger and his team at ILM did a spectacular job of the fire and her coming out of it, just to say that. That just made it a pleasure to work with. And I can tell you that there were issues with, you know, where you have fire and you have smoke, and then that scene where they're discussing it, you have, you know, an enclosed environment, and you have certain shots were crystal clear, and other shots where you know, there's lots of smoke and the diffused lighting, and so it was about lining up the blacks in that and making sure that you had a consistent feel throughout. And so some we would reduce the contrast generally to give a smoky sense, and some we'd increase the contrast and pull down just the deepest parts of the blacks to give a sense of when we'd have to lift something that was maybe a little underexposed to give it a sense of true blacks at the low end. We'd also, there were scenes where you could see through the slats of the teepee that they were in. And, John wouldn't want to see the activity outside, so you'd have to key in and track mats to suppress what was going on outside so it didn't distract. Also, scenes around the fire when she comes out, there were scenes that it was a little bit of a dusk or dawn look. You were seeing a little bit of blue on the horizon, so we keyed into the skyline and did some garbage mats and took out all that blue so it really looked like a truly black sky and kind of shaped the image to, again, support the narrative and keep the focus on the main characters.
I'm guessing because it didn't look it, but did you do work on the characters' eyes? Because obviously we need to see their eyes to get the story. And I felt like in this film that, unlike several other Westerns where you kind of lost that maybe pre the days of DI, we always seemed to be able to see what the characters were thinking because we could see their eyes.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that's a big focus of many people is, and a use of the DI is to be able to, when you are losing the eyes, just go in and do a careful roto of the general shapes and the contours and track that. And one of the things I've really discovered in that is that really you need to be somewhat of an animator, because you need to consider the contour of the face and the eyes and the brows, and you need to carefully construct in a very fluid way a mat that, you know, if the geometry of the mat looks fluid and nice and the flow of it looks fluid and nice, you're going to have a much better chance of pulling off lifting the eyes in a convincing way. The other thing you do is, if you lift the eyes, I'll often pull down, you know, set a threshold of where I want my blacks to be, and I'll pull down just the deepest part of the black. So though you are opening up, you're not milking the blacks. You're going back and just in the areas which is with this, some very subtle curves manipulated, you can get those blacks back down while still lifting the eyes. So yes, we've done that. Also, sometimes just a slight sharpening through that mat of the eyes gives a heightened intensity to the gaze, and that wasn't done tons, but a little bit in this movie, and that can be a great aid as well. And again, it's all via the direction of the creatives and a well-informed opinion occasionally about what we can do and what might be good to do.
What were the light levels like on that stuff? Because you're shooting anamorphic, but if you went fully wide open, sometimes those anamorphics can do odd things. Was it...
Mm-hmm. It was very well shot, and generally there were very few issues with regards to losing faces, and if we did, it was intentional. So there wasn't. I've been through movies where it seems like every shot of certain characters were doing that. This was not one of those movies. It was just a little accent occasionally where we wanted to open something up, and sometimes it was opening it up, and then, you know, for example, if you got somebody that they're highlighted by the fire and wanted to get more of a sense of that fire and being in a dark room, they would actually darken the other side of the face, and we'd track mats for that.
And, of course, Olivia Wilde is sort of famously naked in this scene. Did you do anything to her skin tones? Because she needed to look perfect for plot reasons.
Yeah, she'd be nothing without me. No, I'm kidding. You can't improve on perfection. She's pretty much there. She is just she has beautiful skin tone, beautiful complexion, and so there have been times when you want to be as kind and helpful to someone as you possibly can be, and you do whatever you can, and there's some remarkable things you can do. This was not one of those occasions.
And any of the male actors, I'm not talking specifically about the leads, did you try to do anything to kind of go the other way, make them look kind of more rugged, make them look more contrasty? Because obviously there are banditos, there are, you know, sort of lots of people in this film that aren't necessarily happy, perky people.
You know, Mike, I want to work in this town again. So generally, with this caliber of stars, that's
I was not referring to the stars.
No, and we have had to, usually if you're going to do something like that, it's going to be an ancillary character.
Yeah.
Like a, you know, character actor where, you know, you want to do that. But and then I will say, for example, in Iron Man, with Tony Stark, when he was dying, we would like do a mat on his skin and track that and kind of drain the color from it. And I think there were a couple of scenes where we did that with Daniel, but very, very, very slightly. I would say, you know, it was some of the scenes when he was in the operating table with the alien. It was very harrowing moments. Also, to say that's a really good example in that operating sequence, which is a very interesting and odd color palette, but very effective. That was another situation where we're in here and we were experimenting and exploring with Roger, did some style frames that he was able to reference to some degree. And I'd like to think that helped things move in the direction that everybody was happy with.
So on a film like this, obviously you're the supervising senior colorist. How many people are, or like, what's your team?
Well, my team is critical and central to this is my my producer, my DI producer, and his assistant. That's Mike Dillon and Tim Sellen. Our editorial team is fantastic, but really, really so important are the second colorists, as we call them, who basically support the work I do and do a lot of the heavy lifting. In a particular note is Andrew Francis, who did a spectacular job and has a real artistic background that comes to bear and bears great fruit in making this work, and also Charles Buneg, who has a matte painting background. Andrew took a more lead role in this, but both Andrew and Charles are instrumental, and they're incredibly talented artists who not only have the background of traditional timing, but also art and composition that they bring to bear on this.
Is that what you look for when you're building a team, people that have those skills outside sort of the technical, because you've obviously got such a strong technical team there?
Yes, and we do. But, you know, the truth is I'm not that technical. My background is in painting and illustration, and that's the most important aspect of what I do. I have worked really hard to master the technical side of it, to the point where I don't think about how am I going to do something. I just know how to do it. But as I said before, I don't know how you do this without having that artistic foundation, because so many times it's about what's going to make the shot look convincing. And unless you know about, you know, how a shot can look convincing because of the particulars, perspective aspects or the reflection aspects of water or sky or how to get distance in a convincing way, it's very hard to do. I'll tell you what, there's if you go onto the Pixar website and if you look for what they are looking for their artists, they don't tell you to learn software. They don't tell you to learn a certain kind of package. They don't tell you to learn the technical aspects. They tell you to go to schools that are going to teach you how to be creative, how to observe the world around you, and how to have big ideas. And I think that is so right on. And one of my second colors, Charles Buneck, he didn't even know what a DI was when I hired him. His background was strictly in matte painting and, you know, basically digital matte painting and traditional analog painting. And I had to tell him, well, here's what DI is, and here's why I think you'd be good at it. And he has turned out to be just spectacular at it. It helped me. It was just critical in getting Thor and Captain America done, and I'm really so proud of him. And I'm just even more convinced that artistic background is so important. And I'll give you one particular example. I had a sequence in Thor where that was overcast, and we had to do to do something to give a sense of brightness and light in the sky. So I drew a mat of some cloud shapes, and I put some blue behind it so it looked like instead of just a flat gray sky, there was actually a blue sky behind it, behind these clouds we'd done. And I said to Charles, I need this whole sequence done like this. I need to do mats for me. And he did the most beautiful, artistic, believable, convincing work for that entire sequence. And I thought, you know what? Thank God, because only an artist could do this. Only an artist could draw and paint like this when you need it. So That's been very important to me.
So let's get back to, you obviously have done a bunch of films lately, including Cowboys and Aliens. In fact, The Help is one of yours as well, isn't it?
Yes, correct.
And you're working on, I believe, something I'm really looking forward to, which is Red Tails.
Yes.
So that seems to be going terrifically well, just judging by the trailer. So I'm wondering, looking forward on films, if we can discuss just a philosophical thing, not aimed at Red Tails in particular, but there's a move, obviously, by the Academy to move towards ACES and a more unified OpenEXR color workflow. And some of these films we've been discussing, especially an Iron Man 2 or earlier films, classically going to be in a DPX and Cineon color space. Do you have any opinion on that sort of move by the Academy in terms of approaches to a more unified color space? Because I guess it's primarily designed at digital acquisition, unlike Cowboys and Aliens, and trying to sort of unify camera space a bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I know that's a big push for the AFC as well. And their color decision list and the work they're doing toward that end too. You know, it's such a transitional period right now, and it's so vastly more complex than when you were dealing with film alone. That was a tried and true known quantity. There, you know, you've got the Genesis, you've got the Alexa, you've got the Canon, you've got all of these various capture mediums and film and various types of film, and it's all being sorted out now. I think the people will jump on one bandwagon and will do things a certain way, and then another one comes along, and I think it's really going to depend on what the demands of the marketplace are and what turns out to be the easiest to use and what makes the most sense economically that's going to drive any of these decisions. I think anything that codifies and standardizes the material is going to be a benefit. But right now we're just kind of flying by the seat of our pants. I'll tell you, it's very exciting because one of the things we're really enjoying a great deal is before you were really limited to what can film do. And I love film. I love film in particular as a capture medium. And when you have a great print, and you rarely have a great print from film, you have the best possible way of showing a film sometimes, you know, because you can get the depth of blacks you can get in film is still unparalleled. And there's something about, you know, if you have a dark scene, you're going to get more information when you're viewing it on a great piece of, let's say, Hicon stock. You'll see things in the blacks that you're not even capable of seeing in digital projection. So I think that you know, we're still in transition, and I welcome the fact that we now are not limited exclusively to film exhibition, and that we can actually play in various color spaces and really see some of the details and the highlights that we couldn't before. And we're doing lots of experimentation on films with these who are very brave and really pushing the envelope. And you know, we can see exposures where before you just look out into a field and you'd see a blown out sky and a dark line of trees, and now you can see all the detail in the trees, and you can see all the detail in the sky, and you can see the detail in the sun that you're practically staring right into. So playing with those color spaces and working that way is probably the most exciting aspect of all of this. At the same time, I just want to kind of give this caveat. My background is in painting and illustration, and I'm really kind of spoiled in working with eFilm because we've got a whole color science department. And those are the very issues they deal with. What I love is getting the material in and exploring with it as any artist would do. And I've never gotten too caught up in the actual pipeline other than how it affects the work I'm doing and what I need to know to produce the best results. And I can always consult with our phenomenal color science team when I need to do that.
Well, I know that Red Tails, we're not going to discuss that, but I believe that's being shot digitally. But let's go back to some of your, I mean, you did Gulliver's Travels, that was shot digitally. I mean, and I'm not talking now creatively in terms of anything critical, but I mean, you must be very aware of the differences when you're getting Genesis footage on a Gulliver's versus film footage on a, I don't know, I think, what, Sex and the City 2 or something, I think that was shot on film. Like, you must be feeling that difference in the grade, or is it so neutralized in your workflow that it's not that you don't notice the difference? Of course you would know.
Oh, no. But you notice the difference big time. And, you know, there are just pluses and minuses to any of these workflows. And, you know, you have to make adjustments and get used to working and get used to how differently the material responds when you're working in a different medium. When I was first working on Gulliver's, I noticed that any time we brought something down, the blacks just raced down and they would get crunched very quickly. And very quickly, we worked on a lookup table that mitigated that circumstance. So, you know, again, having a great color science team is just so invaluable to being able to face those issues as they come up. I can also say in Captain America recently when, you know, we had certain sequences of shots where we wanted to accentuate certain colors and it just didn't seem like we were able to do it to our satisfaction by our traditional timing methods, we worked with our color science team, came up with an input LUT that actually did 90% of the work right in the LUT. And, you know, we can have any number of input LUTs built for any particular show and really customize it based on the needs and the requests and the desires of the DP or the creative team.
And to link this back to what you started with, it seems like many of the DPs that you're working with being ones at the top of their game are very comfortable with that as part of the almost the cinematography process now.
Oh yeah, once they understand it, and it's a little tricky to understand, but once they understand that, hey, we're not really limited right now. You know, most of presentations are going to be done on digital cinema. It's kind of past that threshold of 50%, and so you really don't have to worry so much about what your constraints are in film. You know, be free, try things. And yes, they respond very well to that.
And so I guess if you are giving advice to people moving forward, what I'm hearing from you is twofold. One is to get as involved as early as possible, especially in terms of the colorist being in front of the visual effects. And secondly is to be kind of brave with it.
Absolutely. And it's up front and as in front as you possibly can be, and that means we're very heavily involved. You know, Lex is a big thing now, and it's really a fabulous, fabulous camera. And the material I see, we've done extensive tests, and it's really extraordinary, extraordinary. So much information in the toe and the shoulder of that. I would say the only deficit I've seen so far, and it's very minor, is that if you look at film and if you look at the latitude of the high end of film, you know, you've got more information in film in the high end. It's got a little more latitude, but so yes, it goes back to the fact that we're doing a huge show right now where we are doing all of the on-set dailies. So we know that we've sent out a team, a literal team of color scientists out to the set. They have all of the monitors calibrated. They know that everything is properly calibrated. The file formats, the naming conventions, everything is buttoned down and nailed down so that we, right from the very beginning, are able to contribute our expertise to the entire pipeline. And it's so much better to do that than to, you know, get to the DI and then discover, oh my gosh, what are all these issues and problems? I review the dailies for every show I work on that we do the dailies for. So that's an incredible advantage because I can flag issues that I see early on or just monitor and see how the material is coming in and get a sense of where they want to go by the time they do walk in with the DI, we've dealt with it. But we have a very seamless pipeline that I think would be very hard to match. And also just the experience, particularly in Alexa lately, of just having dealt with big shows and lots of volume of materials and parsing out two VFX vendors and making sure that stuff is pre-timed for whatever VFX plates are being done. So, yeah, DI, you should be as involved as early with them as possible, right in the initial discussions before a frame of footage is ever shot.
Well, look, thank you so much for taking time to talk us through your process. We really appreciate it, and it's been a great pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
Well, you know, that's my pleasure, and also something that just happened actually 2 days ago. There's a new book called Hire Me Hollywood that actually is asking a number of professionals in the industry how they started out and what they did and some of the seminal moments in what made their career. And I was very fortunate to be interviewed for that. So it's kind of an interesting book, and just seeing the various paths people have taken in this industry. So.
Yeah, no, that is Stan Winston or somebody in that? There's some really interesting people they talk to, or at least maybe that's confusing that, but they talk to a bunch of people, don't they, in that book? Am I right?
Oh, yeah. Just many people, many different paths, and it just reminds me of what we spent a lot of time discussing there, too. But
it is a good book,
It's just I remember what it was like not to know anything about the industry, because when I started out, I didn't know anyone. I didn't have anybody I could really talk to. And you're always curious, of course, about, well, you know, and how did people get started? So anyway, it's kind of interesting from that perspective.
Well, thanks so much. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's a pleasure talking to you.
All right, well, thanks to Mike and to Steve for that conversation. I have to say there are sections of that discussion that I think should be required listening for anyone starting out in the business, and perhaps reviewing even for veterans when you're feeling just a little bit beat up. All right, well, that'll do it for this FX podcast. Oh, wait, I wanted to mention that at IBC, both John and I had several people stop us in the halls and tell us how much they enjoyed various aspects of the sites, in particular pointing out classes at FX PhD. One fellow told us about how he went from taking our classes to starting his own company using classes we did on starting a facility to winning awards for his work, all of which he attributed to things he learned at FX PhD. I mean, this is really nice. Really appreciate people stopping us, and really the fact that we're able to contribute to the community in that way. It's been fantastic, and the feedback has been great. Another person told us they provide each new employee with a year of FX PhD training paid for by the company, and he said that people said, well, but I'm a roto artist and there's not enough roto classes. And he would encourage them to take new skills. Take a Cinema 4D class, for example. And he said every time they've come back just raving about the classes and feeling like they expanded their knowledge, and it's been good for the person and the company. And I'm not just saying this as a plug. This is just what amazes me to travel all over the world and meet people who really get what we're trying to do with these sites and take full advantage of everything. So I just want to say thanks to all those who took the time to say hello and to mention it to us. All right, well, that'll do it for this podcast. For John Montgomery and Mike Seymour, I'm Jeff Huser. We'll see you on the next FX Podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.